Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
And I'm Jordan Crook.
And this week, Daryl Etherington is in San Francisco for our Enterprise Conference. It's kind of weird that they didn't want us there.
I think it's super weird. I was spooked by it. I'm not feeling great about my... I'm just kidding. I'm really glad I didn't have to go. But
me too.
Well, only because, see, like, TechCrunch events are badass, and I'm obsessed with them. Obviously, it's like the main focus of what I do. But we have Disrupt in like a month, and it just takes all of my energy. And I feel like going to an event in San Francisco like exactly 1 month before it is just bad, bad self-care on my part, you know?
Right. Well, and you'd feel this like sense of accomplishment afterwards, and then you'd be like, oh shit, I now have to go back to organizing Disrupt.
Yeah, exactly. And like, now's the sprint time. We got like, we're getting, making sure all our moderators are prepped and doing final touches on the agenda and stuff. I mean, it's, but if you haven't checked out the Disrupt agenda, just for a shameless plug right now, you really should. I've been to like more than 20 Disrupts now in my TechCrunch tenure. And I have to say that based on the agenda, I really think this one's going to be the one. If you had to pick one, this one should be the one you go to. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, I agree. And I didn't put the agenda together. So you can trust me. I totally think it's great.
I'm a little biased, but.
And there's, I believe, at least one other speaker that we haven't announced yet that should be coming soon. So keep an eye out for some announcements.
Yeah, big surprises coming your way. So anyways, let's talk about TV a little bit, yeah?
Yeah, let's do that. So last week, we reviewed The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance, which I think we, you know, had a little bit of disagreement about, but like fundamentally, you know, we liked... It seemed like we liked the sort of fantasy stuff. We liked some of what we were impressed by it, but the puppets were a little bit hard to get used to. Is that, that's fair?
I think it's fair. It was like hard to like, it felt like a very adult story being told with puppets, and that kind of threw me a little bit, but I was impressed by it. It seems like an incredible technological feat, and I'm sure there are people out there who can't get enough of it, you know? So go for it.
So, if you guys have thoughts on anything that we review or the job we're doing, you can always email us at originalcontent@techcrunch.com. And if it's an interesting comment, we will read it on the show. So for The Dark Crystal, we got some tweets in response to the post, and it seemed like mostly enthusiastic. Olufemi Onikola said, "Love the original. Sure, this one will be awesome." And seems like a fair sentiment. Carl Heavisides said there was an amazing cast too, which I totally agree with. And we talked a lot about how crazy that cast was on the episode. And then Tash, who's actually at NK Null, tweeted, "Just watched the first episode tonight. I was captivated and a little creeped out." Which is part of the reaction that we had too.
Yeah, Tash and I feel like are right here with each other. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's how I felt as well. Tash gets me.
And that's pretty much the response. I mean, it seems like in general, people have been pretty into the show.
Yeah, people seem to be into it. I mean, that's what you guys kind of predicted, I think, that there would be a crowd for this. I'm just not part of it, but... Yeah, it was fine. It was good.
Yeah, that's the beauty of Netflix is you don't like one thing, there's a million other things. And that's part of, I mean, actually kind of what I like about the show is I feel like we have the show now, meaning Original Content, the podcast, because I feel like we have like really different perspectives on it. And so like the goal isn't necessarily, I feel like sometimes we'll get very worked up about like, you didn't like the thing that I liked or you liked the thing that I didn't like. But to me, like the whole point of having a conversation like this is to get different perspectives and to get, you know, like people with very different taste weighing in on why they did or didn't like something.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's interesting too, because we all have things where we overlap, you know, like you and Daryl love like the superhero stuff. And all three of us, I think, are drawn to like space stuff. And Daryl and I love like trash reality television. you know, I think you and I are, we're probably the least overlapped on the Venn diagram, but we still have things where we're both like, we loved it. You know what I mean? So it just goes to show, man, art, bringing people together. It's just can't be said enough. Although I don't know if we can call everything we reviewed art.
At least certainly not successful art. I mean, maybe that's what it aspires to, but it doesn't always get there. And I'm not sure The Bachelor in Paradise even aspires to it.
That's the highest form of art. Okay. That's like human condition playing out before your eyes. Okay, wait, didn't you have news? Was there something about YouTube
you wanted to talk about? Yeah, so YouTube, the big news about YouTube is the fact that they basically reached this settlement with the Federal Trade Commission this week, which was around the fact that they were basically using ad targeting on children's videos, which under privacy laws you're not supposed to do. Like, if you can't collect any data about about the person watching, about a kid watching, unless the parent has given permission. So there's like a lot of different components to this settlement. I think a lot of people sort of felt like YouTube was getting away with a slap in the wrist because it was, you know, fined like I think a few $100 million, which to Google is nothing. And they're also going to now ask people whether or not they're uploading children's content, so that if it turns out to be children's content, if people say it's children's content, they'll have to not put any ad trackers on there. But it sort of seems dumb that they weren't doing this already. And then the last step of it, which is maybe the most relevant to this podcast, although, I mean, YouTube in general is obviously, really central to this whole landscape, even though we don't talk about it much because they don't really push out a lot of original content and the scripted original content that we talk about. But they're going to be, they said they're going to be investing $100 million in original children's content, partly to offset any of the potential downsides to the fact that, you know, all this ad tracking is going to go away. So potentially a lot of children's video makers might lose some ad revenue, although arguably, they shouldn't have been making that ad revenue in the first place because, you know, it wasn't, they shouldn't be targeting kids like that.
So is it illegal to target advertisements towards kids? Is that not like a thing we're allowed to do? Because there are toy commercials all over the place.
You're not, right. So there's like, there's targeting means different things, right? So like targeting on TV just means, hey, it's a commercial for kids. And I think usually, I don't know what the law is now, but when I was growing up, you could have it, but you had to be very, very, very clear that it was a commercial, which is why, like, if you watched, you know, cartoons and stuff, there'd be like these messages that are like, after these messages, we'll be right back and stuff like that, because it had, because kids don't know what a commercial is unless you really, really tell them. And that's different from this versus it's more like when I talk about targeting, it's really data collection. It's the idea of, hey, you know, your computer and your web browser know certain things about you. We're going to collect that data and we're going to serve you an ad based on that data. And you're not allowed to do that to kids unless you have their parents' permission. And that's essentially what YouTube was doing. I mean, I think not necessarily intentionally, but in the sense that there's just a ton of kids' content on YouTube. I don't think they necessarily do a great job of distinguishing what is and isn't kids' content. And you know, to a certain extent, that's just because of what YouTube is. It's kind of the Wild West. And so they just have to deal with the fact that potentially there could be stuff that's for kids and it's sort of set up. But you know, the ads are the same that you would get with adult content, which, I mean, is sort of problematic in all kinds of ways.
So they got a couple hundred million fine?
Yeah, it was...
That must have hurt.
$170 million.
It's like the same amount that they spend on guacamole in a year or something. Like, it's not even like.
Right. Oh. And when I talk to normal people, I think that's one of the things they have a hard time getting their heads around is just that for a lot of the companies that we're talking about, the amounts of money are just so crazy. Like, we are in this world where, not personally, but in terms of the companies we write about, like a few million dollars, nothing. Tens of millions of dollars, still not that much. And then for the giants like Google and YouTube, $170 million, really nothing.
Well, it's possible. This is as uninformed as a thought can get. So just bear with me on it, but like we're hearing a lot in the debates and through the campaign right now for the presidency, like, you know, how tech firms and big companies are going to get, you know, should specific Democratic candidates get elected, that we would see a lot of fines and a lot of, you know, a lot more money essentially coming from these tech companies, whether it's through taxes or fines or regulatory issues. And so we could see those numbers go up. Like, it's hard to imagine, like, what was Facebook fined? Like $5 billion or something?
Yeah, there was a privacy settlement with a fine of, I think it was $5 billion.
And people were like, oh my God, $5 billion is nothing for Facebook, which is true. It's a lot for, you know, the United States government. So I don't know. Maybe we'll see those numbers go up. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I could imagine that it seems like the environment is changing, and that's going to continue to be the case. I think the one other thing that's interesting about this news is just, to me, like when I see stuff like this, it always just makes me reflect on how incredibly ubiquitous YouTube is when you're talking about kids. That like virtually every time I'm around young children, which granted is not a lot because I don't have any children of my own. My siblings and close friends don't have any like children, but occasionally I'm around small children and there's always YouTube on. Like it's, you know, in the way that maybe when I was growing up, there was like always a TV on in the background, YouTube is the thing that's on. And so it makes sense that, you know, that there should be a lot more regulation around this. And even, you know, spending $100 million on content is not that much in the grand scheme of things when you're talking about like comparing to like a Netflix or, you know, any of these companies, Disney, Apple, they're all like spending billions of dollars on content. But
we're also talking about like a group of kids that could essentially become mm-hmm. like YouTube users, like for their entire lives. Like not the way that we're YouTube users, but right. like as a replacement for like all content. Because I mean, I have the same observation as you do that like when we were at that event, what was it? Mobility in San Francisco, Richard's son, Hugo, who's like not maybe a year old now. He was at the event, and at the end we went to like the reception, and Richard obviously had been through it and his wife was exhausted as well. They have a little child running around, a toddler who's on his feet and flying around all over the place. And I was like, I'll take Hugo for a few minutes so you guys can network and stuff. I'm tired. I just want to sit anyway. And he was so antsy, and all I had to do was put on Shark Doot Doo on Baby Shark on YouTube. And then that kid, he sat there silently for 45 minutes just watching YouTube. Like, and we're talking about a one-year-old. Like, that kid, I mean, it could be Shark Doot Doo more so than YouTube. I'm sure his brand loyalty lies with sharks and not YouTube. But, like, you could see how that would evolve, right? Like, in the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. That it's just, we really have no idea how dramatic a shift this is going to be. That there's this, like, generation of kids who are basically spending most or all of their free time with YouTube. And like, I'm not trying to be like sort of alarmist in the sense of like YouTube is rotting their brains or anything, but more just that's so different. But A, maybe, and B, like, even if it's not, it's such a different like media consumption like pattern than, you know, even like watching Netflix, that like if I were running a big media company, I would be like really freaked out about what people are going to be interested in 20 or 30 years from now.
Well, and you're asking a lot of parents too, to be like, okay, well, I'm going to go. I mean, I think that all technology asks a lot of parents at this point, right? Because you have to have your kids log into everything and, you know, set all the settings to be the right way and make sure they're on the kids platform and not the adult version of the platform, blah, blah, blah. But it seems like a lot to ask to go in and like monitor someone's YouTube use or set the settings properly. But I don't know, maybe I've never actually gone into YouTube and tried to do that. Maybe it's super easy and obvious, but I don't imagine that it is.
I do think, to be fair to them, there is apparently a separate YouTube Kids app. And so that one has a lot of this other stuff kind of stripped away. And I think in that case, the idea at least is that you should be able to just be like, all right, here's YouTube Kids, turn it on, you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. But I have to imagine there are a lot of parents and kids who aren't going in through YouTube Kids and they're just going in through regular YouTube.
Right.
Well, let's move on to Carnival Row, which is a new series on Amazon Prime Video. And it stars Orlando Bloom and Cara Delevingne. Mm-hmm. How would you describe the show?
Like Harry Potter for adults, kind of like a mix.
Oh, I like that.
Like Harry Potter, if Harry Potter and Game of Thrones had a baby that mostly took after Harry Potter and was made for adults, I think is kind of like Game of Thrones is giving it a lot of credit, unless you're talking about like the last three seasons, in which case Carnival Row is better than the last three seasons of Game of Thrones. But, you know, I would describe it as that. It's like a very fantasy, but more like adult kind of, at least trying to be a little bit more grown up and serious and really like pin itself to its underlying drama and not necessarily like the visuals or the magic of everything. It's trying to. I don't know if it's accomplishing that balance as well as it would like to, but it's aiming for that. And I would give it like a B+, I think. How would you describe the show? Yeah. What are your thoughts?
I agree that it. I think Harry Potter for adults is a good way to put it. It's sort of in this, because I think sometimes when you say fantasy, you think Game of Thrones, you think Lord of the Rings, and even though those are very different, they're both in these sort of medieval settings with dragons and magic. And this has magic, but it's not medieval. It's like, I think at first I assumed it would be like late 19th century, but I think it's a little bit closer to earlier 20th century because they do have like some pretty like crazy machine mm-hmm. guns and stuff. And so it's this kind of steampunk era civilization where they, you know, there's trains and zeppelins and, but also fairies and
it felt very like magic. World War II almost like that, like 1940s is the vibes I got, which could be like a function of the plot itself with the kind of war that rages at the beginning. But
yeah,
it's an interesting.
So, right. So the setup is essentially in this world, there's like this whole like explanation at the beginning, which I had a hard time remembering, but essentially there's been this war between these two, I think, human civilizations.
Well,
but then sort of caught in the middle were the Fae.
Yeah, we have to start at the beginning. The homeland of the Fae was myth and legend for centuries. No one thought they would actually find it. And then when they found it, they had a war that lasted many, many years. I don't know if they actually said how many years, but a long, long time mm-hmm. between the right. Pact and the Berg. These are two like human civilizations on the same planet, I assume.
Yeah, I think it's all on one planet.
And then we start the show 7 years after the war has ended. The Berg essentially retreated. And the Pact won the war and now occupies the Fae homeland.
Right. And the show mostly takes place in the Berg. So it's sort of in the losing civilization. And there's this flood of refugees from Tir na n'og, where the Fae are from. And as a result, what happens is there's sort of this backdrop that's like clearly meant to evoke a lot of contemporary politics mm-hmm. around immigration. And they're very on the nose and very direct about it. But that's for the most part kind of the background. And then the main story is, you know, focuses on these two characters, Philo, who's human, played by Orlando Bloom. There's Vignette, who's a Fae, played by Cara Delevingne. They were sort of formerly in a relationship. And back during the war, and Vignette comes to the Berg as a refugee, while Philo is an inspector in the police force, and he's basically investigating these initially just sort of these attacks on the Fae, but then it sort of spreads out to this bigger conspiracy and these really brutal murders. There's a lot going on in this show, and I think, to a certain extent, you know, so there's only 8 episodes and we can talk about this a little bit more when we get into spoilers. But I do think that the show in some ways, 8 episodes doesn't quite feel like it's enough. It feels like they're sort of trying to get through a lot. And so you have things that happen very quickly and aren't necessarily given the full amount of time that they deserve. I mean, that's it. I really enjoyed it. And thought like it was just as like sort of like soap opera and fun fantasy. It was enjoyable and entertaining and didn't really look like any other TV show I'd seen before. But, you know, I think that on a writing level, I would agree that it's probably about a B+, because I think if they just had a few additional hours, I don't think that would have solved all the problems, but I think that would have helped quite a bit, just let the story develop a little bit more organically.
Yeah, and maybe gone for a bit more of an ensemble look. Like, I didn't finish all of it. I think I watched like 5 episodes, and I don't know, maybe stories collide better than I felt like they did. And it's not to say that there's a shortage of characters, but it feels a little bit like these episodes are really, they start a little bit wide, and then as you get deeper into the season, it really feels like it's zeroing in on this plot line between Philo and Vignette. And it just feels like there's an opportunity to have an A and a B and a C plot happening maybe a little bit more like AAA plots. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just felt a little bit like there was room for that in this big, big world that they created. I feel like it also might take a little pressure off of Orlando and Kara, who, you know, I don't want to say that they're terrible actors. I mean, Orlando Bloom has had a relatively successful career. I don't think that he's like an A-level actor at all. Cara Delevingne
shown a lot of range.
Exactly. And Cara Delevingne is newer to acting. I think there's lots of potential there. I don't know that she reaches it with this necessarily, but I think it's definitely an A for effort. Like, she clearly tried very hard, and it's not bad. It's really not bad from Cara Delevingne. It's just not good, you know? And I think like going more of an ensemble route, more of a like multiple threads being woven at the same time might have taken some of the pressure off of them as having to like kind of carry these weighty emotional performances throughout. But there is a pretty cool cast. We had Ilaria Sand from Game of Thrones was in it. I think there was some other Game of Thrones people in there too. The guy who says Mother of Dragons when Khaleesi comes to Karth, he was in it too. The like ghost man who murdered all the Karthians. Do you remember that?
Oh, I don't remember who that is.
The guy who lived in the big pillar.
That period of Game of Thrones is very, my memory has wiped out that part of the Daenerys storyline just because
it was kind of slow.
It kind of got boring for a while.
She was out in the desert. It was not a lot was happening, but it had him, and then there's
right, and she's like shouting where her dragons are, and
yeah, where are my dragons? And then there was one other dude who I couldn't place, but I know he's from Game of Thrones.
Well, so, I mean, the one person who I recognized the most in that supporting cast, there's Jared Harris, who plays the Chancellor, and he was in The Queen. He played the...
That's what it was. It wasn't Game of Thrones. Yeah. He's in The Queen. That's what I recognize him from. Okay, sorry.
And he's also in Chernobyl. He's in a bunch of stuff, but Chernobyl. I recognized him mostly from The Queen. Because he was the best thing about The Queen, and like single-handedly made me a supporter of the monarchy. And I was like, yes, this is if this guy was king, I would be on board. He's great. and he's great in this. He's you know, I don't think the writing in this is as good as it is in The Queen. But like when Jared Harris and his wife, Piety, played by Indira Varma / Ilaria Sand, when they're on screen, I think that is like the best version of the show because they're just such good performers.
Yeah, they really are. And I liked a different look from Ilaria. That's I only know her from Game of Thrones. I'm sure she's been in other stuff, and I'm actually sure I've seen her in other stuff, but that's the role that really sticks with me. And it was cool to see her in a slightly different, but also kind of similar, right? Like she's kind of playing the same tone, but she had a very different look and a different kind of aesthetic about her performance, which I appreciated. I will say one other gripe that I have is that I felt like the names of people were like you could tell, I feel like, that like one person was in charge of naming everyone, and it was like the same aesthetic. It was like the same cadence, and like there are a lot of two syllable last names, Stone Moss, Spurn Rose, you know, mm-hmm. Longerbane is actually three, but it was like the same kind of idea. And I get part of it has to do with like, they live in the Burg and like, here's how people's names work in the Burg, right? And like, here's how the Fae's naming nomenclature works, right? Like, I get all that, but it just, I don't know, it kind of distracted me a little bit. It's such a weird like thing to pick at, but I was just like, ugh, can't we just get like a John here or something? It just feels like everybody's got to have a weird name, you know?
It took me a while to get used to it. I mean, I think the one thing I will say in its favor is I think it's consistent. It's not like the thing where sometimes you feel like, oh, they like put a lot of effort into the main characters' names and then like all the supporting characters, there's like, I don't know, you're whatever. And it feels like this sort of consistent world. But I agree that they're very sort of high fantasy kind of names, and you either, you know, go with it or you don't. Or in my case, I think at first, yeah, having those names was a little bit of a distraction. But as the show went on, I got used to it. I mean, one of the other things about the show is just that it has... you know, it sort of functions kind of similar to Game of Thrones and other prestige cable shows in that there's a fair amount of sex and nudity. And for this show, that means there is sex with fairies, and you will see like wings involved in the process. And on the one hand, I mean, it sort of feels very immature to kind of just point at it and laugh. But I genuinely think, I mean, that is a moment in the first episode where I was just like, what the fuck am I watching?
Yeah. Also, like, I hate to be this person because I tend to break the rules for the things I really like, and then I get really strict about it for the stuff I don't like. But like, just some logic in there and mixed in with that scene. So can I, are we cool with me spoiling the first episode sex scene a little bit, or?
Yeah. Let's say we're during this non-spoiler discussion, we'll kind of spoil a little bit in the first episode.
Yeah. So the sex scene shows a female fairy having sex with a male human, and the fairy's on top, and she's lifted him up off of the bed and is having sex with him while flying and holding on to him. And I just, like, they make a point to say that the fairies have hollow bones so that they can hold their own weight up, but like, how you fly in with a full weight of a man, and also like, how strong are their legs that they can like grip onto a dude and like hold him up out of the air while fucking? Like, it's just like a lot to like, but like, fairies are magical, so maybe like it's their magic that allows them to do that. And they're supposed to, you know, there does seem to be the theme of like, sex with fairies is amazing, and like, not like sex with humans, and it's much better, and they have magical sex or whatever. But I was a little bit like, I was at, on the one hand, I was like, wow, this is fucking crazy. And on the other hand, I was like, she can't lift him. Like, this is bullshit. So I don't know.
I think that's fair, because you're supposed to, I think, I don't think everything about the fairies is supposed to be magical. And I do think like some of it is supposed to obey basic rules of physics. But I will also admit that in that scene, I was not necessarily thinking so much about the physics as just kind of like, WTF. And I mean, I guess I'm also just curious in general how you felt about, because I mean, part of that, you know, the sort of just being impressed in both good and bad ways by the show is just the way it is sort of jumbling, you know, like the stuff that you think of as very child story, kind of fairy tale, Harry Potter, and the more serious things. And so like the fact that it's a show that has this, you know, spends a fair amount of time on these like immigration politics and racism and things like that. But then, I mean, that half of the main cast or a good portion of the main cast are these various fantastical beings, particularly the Fae, who have, you know, these insect wings, and who for large stretches of the show, you can tell the, like, I think they use CGI wings when they're flying and those look pretty good. But then they have, when they're sort of just sitting there, you can tell it's just basically like bits of like cloth or costume that are wearing on their backs. So I mean, there's something about them that kind of looks a little bit silly, and you just kind of register them as slightly silly, and then you're supposed to take a lot of this stuff very seriously. I mean, were you able to sort of get on board with
that? Yeah, I think like what you're saying is absolutely on point. Like I was more on board with it when they were flying and I was like, oh, I get it. Yeah. But then there was even one scene where Vignette, I don't know if this was just laziness or this was, I don't know what it was, but she is standing there, like you were saying, she's not flying and her wings are coming through the back of her jacket, but like also, you know, when you're a little kid and you dress up as like a fairy or whatever, and you, it's like straps, like backpack straps that you put on to like have your wings on your back. Like that is what she had. Like she had like two little red, like she was wearing one and it looked kind of like it was supposed to be stitched into the jacket. Like that was just like the style of the jacket had this stitching in it. But I think in all honesty, she was just like a little, like wearing her wingsuit and it probably should have been under the jacket or something. I don't know. But yeah, I do think that like there were times when it was a little cheesy, you know, but for the most part, I think they pulled off creating a fantasy world that we could take seriously for the most part, like not 100%, but like 87%, the same B plus.
Yeah. I mean, cause I think the main thing for me was the fact that it seemed like everyone on the show took it seriously. Like the characters took it seriously. The writers took it seriously. There wasn't like any winking. And so, you know, over time you just sort of get used to this idea of like, okay, like it's going to be a political intrigue with fairies. And that's just the show that you're watching. And I mean, and I think in some ways it was, you know, kind of clumsy because especially in those early episodes, it can feel very much like you're just watching an immigration debate in the US and it's like the exact same rhetoric. I mean, very intentionally, but it feels kind of on the nose. But I think as the show goes on, it does get a little bit more interesting in terms of like showing how different characters respond to the different kind of fantasy races and how the people of those groups, the Fae, the Critch, the Pucks, all of them feel about different groups too. And there's this sense that it's not just like, okay, the fairies are the good guys, the humans are the bad guys, but you know, that there's like this variety of perspectives and variety of personalities within all these different groups.
I mean, I feel like the immigration debate to me made it much like more interesting, to be honest. Like I felt like it added a new level because I think, not that it's been like played out before, but the idea of like, you know, the humans invading a fantasy homeland, I just like that that's happened. And like that's, there's the opportunity, I think, similar to honestly Dark Crystal, of like we expect it to go in the way of fairies are stronger than you think and they're going to come back and fight for their homeland. And it really kind of took a turn toward this refugee situation and the powers that be in the Burg and the kind of sinister mysteries of these murders and attacks, which I thought was more interesting than where I expected it to head 10 minutes in, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there other things we should talk about before we get into spoilers?
No, I'm ready. I'm ready to be spoiled. I'm missing a couple episodes. So what happened?
Yeah. So yeah, if you don't want to be spoiled for the entire first season of Carnival Row, you should stop listening now. I think the first spoilers we should talk about are actually things you have seen, which are specifically, there's this flashback episode, which is the third episode, and you get sort of the backstory of how Philo and Vignette met. And there's been this sort of question hanging over the first two episodes about why did Philo not just leave Vignette, but that he lied to her and you know, faked his own death so she would believe he was dead.
And I still don't get why he did that.
I mean, I understand it in the sense that it seems very clear, both from this episode and just from the show in general, that like they do not like the idea of that, you know, the Fae in general are not treated well in the Burg, and that specifically the idea of like crossbreeding is completely, you know, a stigma to them. And so that it would be very, very hard for them to build a future together. And so I understand why he felt like, oh, this is going to be, you know, really, really tough for her if I stay with her. And that's also in the shadow of this war where, you know, from everything, we haven't seen a lot of the pact, but from what we've seen, they like are absolutely brutal with the Fae. And so I think he was like, okay, like we've got to break up if we're both going to have a shot. And so the only way to do that, as long as she thinks I'm alive, she's going to try to find me. If she thinks I'm dead, then I can, you know, then I can actually make this breakup stick. But the problem is it all happens like very, very quickly. Like the whole, I mean, part of the problem I think is that they compressed their whole story into this one episode. And they're also trying to show the whole war, all the background of the war. And so as a result, both the falling in love part and the breakup part just feels so rushed.
Super rushed. To the point where I was like having trouble following, obviously. And I still think that, I mean, characters make poor decisions in TV shows all the time. That's how we have problems to solve, right? Like how storytelling happens.
Right.
But it just seems like leaving her, if he really loved her, he wouldn't have left her there to fend for herself with the pact either. Like, I have to say too that like I'm confused a little bit by the character of Vignette, like who she is as a fairy, I guess.
Okay.
Like, because she has this very like strong-willed kind of fiery, you know, there's more there than it seems, which is cool for a fairy, right? You have this little like pixie girl and she's actually kind of like a warrior and like will stand up for herself. But then she's also like super vulnerable, sensitive, hyper emotional, and like I guess that's a well-developed character, but it just kind of seems like contradictory to me that like, but maybe she's just emotional about Philo, you know, maybe like he brings that out in her.
Right. I think there's basically that you do sort of see these two sides of her. One is that in general she's this sort of, you know, very pragmatic, tough person, and then specifically all the stuff to do with her relationship with Philo, which even, you know, it takes him a while to see that, is where you see that vulnerability. I agree that like it still doesn't quite click for me. I don't know how much of that is the writing and how much of that is just, again, I don't think that Cara Delevingne is a bad actress, but she's not necessarily a great one, at least not yet. So like she doesn't create this sort of full character yet. You do see, I mean, the one other time you kind of see her out of control is towards the end of the season, she sees that all the relics that she was trying to protect in Tirnanog have been basically raided and put up in a museum. And she kind of loses her shit about that. But that made sense. That I was like, yeah, of course, like, you know, that she's, I mean, part of it is just she's gone through like so much, like not just what we see, but then this 8-year period where basically all the Fae are being hunted down and she can't leave. She's just smuggling people out of the country and hoping she gets to leave eventually. So, I mean, there's like such extremity there that I sort of do understand that, like, I mean, I just don't know people who've been through that much shit.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm kind of like
being too hard on her,
but I do agree that like, you know, she doesn't, yeah, there's a certain kind of like thing where she's, when they need her to be in this sort of action plot, she's kind of one person. And then partly just because the romance between Philo and Vignette feels so sort of soap opera, like it just feels like you're sort of slightly in a slightly different story with a different person when they shift into that mode.
Well, let's get into the bigger twist.
Yes. So, and then this leads into the larger mystery too, in ways that I will explain, but that in that episode, you find out that Philo is half Fae himself, and that his parents, who he never met, basically cut his wings off when he was a child so that he could pass as a human man. Is that what you were thinking when you used a bigger twist?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know a bigger twist than that, if there is okay. One later in the show. But yeah, he was a Fae all along. And kudos to my lovely girlfriend. She called it like real.
Early. Wow.
She was like, he's a Fae. I was like, I don't think so. And they were like, oh, look at the scars. And I was like, damn it.
That's smart. I totally did not call it either. And so I will now spoil some things for you, which is that where that sort of leads is, so Philo has been investigating these really brutal murders And it sort of becomes clear that there's this creature called a Dark Asher, who is like this sort of agglomeration of like different dead body parts, who's hunting down like a, I think a sort of a fae performer and the headmaster of a school or of an orphanage. And the, you know, sort of their other murder victims as it goes along. And so what eventually becomes clear is that the thing connecting all of these murder victims is they all know Philo's secret. So it's clearly somebody who's trying to cover up, you know, Philo's identity.
Which is weird because it's not Philo. And
it's not. And so what eventually becomes clear is there's this backstory where the first woman who was killed, who was Faye, she's his mother.
Yep.
And the mayor, the chancellor, the Jared Harris character, is his father. And they had an affair many years ago and gave birth to Philo. And then, you know, she decided to keep it secret and have his wings cut off. And she gave him up to an orphanage. And now in the present, Piety, the chancellor's wife, has found out about this. And she, because she's very invested in this prophecy, basically, that the reason she even married the chancellor is because, you know, somebody told her that he was going to be an incredibly powerful person. And then their son was going to be even more powerful and even greater. And so finding out about this identity, that there's this whole other son that she didn't know about, puts her in this, you know, like suddenly seems to put this whole future that she's imagined under threat.
Who? So the chancellor is his dad?
Mm-hmm. That's
oh,
right.
Oh, shit. I missed that part. Okay.
Yeah. That's
so he's that. Philo is going to be the one that's great.
That's what she's worried about. And I think that's presumably where the show is going. So Piety has basically been trying to kill everyone around Philo to hide the fact that he's the chancellor's son, and then she's going to kill Philo himself so that he can't achieve whatever that greatness is.
But that doesn't change the fact that he was the one who was destined to be great. It's not going to make her son any more great. People are dumb, man.
Ugh. Right. And this is actually a whole thing in the show where like one of the characters who's sort of like the spiritual advisor to Piety, she says, like, if I've had this vision, like, you can't change it. Like, at that point, it's locked in. This is going to happen. There's no point in trying to fight it. But Piety is trying to fight it anyway. Or at least, I mean, because it's not, I mean, so then there's this whole other thread about the chancellor's, you know, known son who gets kidnapped. He's the one who has fairy sex in the first episode. And then it turns out that Piety actually, even though, like, it's, you know, she never really is revealed to the world as the person behind it, it actually was Piety kidnapping him as part of this scheme to kind of bring him into line. And so you see that she's kind of has this, you know, very duplicitous, very ruthless streak.
And to get rid of the bear, right? Like she was just like doing some housekeeping. She's like, I'm going to get my son in order. He's going to stop being a party boy. And I'm going to make sure this bear that's annoyed the shit out of me gets killed all in one fell swoop. I just have to kidnap my own son and leave him in a dark, damp place for days. And he knows, right? Like he hears the sound of her heels when he's captured and blindfolded. And then as soon as he returns home, he hears the heels again and he seems to know, right?
Yeah. And so eventually he does confront her about it. And this is also at a point where he, because as part of the fallout from in the rescuing of the chancellor's son, their main political rival was killed because she basically cast the blame on him. And so his daughter then, Sophie Longerbane, kind of takes his place. And so she becomes a bigger character in the later episodes and starts an affair with the chancellor's son. And Piety freaks out when she finds out about this because it turns out she had an affair with this political rival all those years back. So in fact, the chancellor's official son is not his son. So the only true son of the chancellor is Philo.
Oh my goodness.
And then there's sort of this other son in his place, which, I mean, you know, then just sort of increases her panic that like, oh, the son, But she was like, it's fine that like I had an affair with this other guy and actually it's his son because the chancellor doesn't have any other son. So if there's any son who's going to be great, it's going to be my son. And then suddenly she's like, oh, shit, maybe not.
Yeah, wow. She's really been thrown for a loop, which is probably for the best. She's kind of a bitch.
Right. And in that sense, she's sort of similar to where Ilaria Sand goes in the later seasons.
Wow.
No, you don't agree?
I think probably a little bit more gruesome than Ilaria Sand.
That's true. I mean, she's more like pulling the strings. And I mean, Ilaria does some pretty fucked up stuff. And in both cases, I mean, I think she...
But, like, I get Ilaria. Like, Ilaria is, like, not just power hungry. She's slightly power hungry. But her issue is more that, like, her man got killed. Her, you know, her man's brother is seemingly weak and not fighting back for her, you know, her shit. Cersei was responsible for taking her man. So I get why she wanted to kill the little Marcella or whatever. She got it back like twofold, right? From Cersei. So this feels like a little bit more like mastermind and like for all the wrong reasons. Like there's no like revenge happening here. It's just like pure evil, you know?
That's true. I mean, the one thing I would say in Piety's defense is that she doesn't kill any children. So she's got that going for her. But I also think that, I mean, in terms of the character, I think one of the things they do well is there's this sense that like she feels like she's like in too deep now, like and that like she's made all these sacrifices already to put this future into place. So as it sort of escalates and she has to just, you know, kill more and more people in order to protect, you know, her family and her son's destiny, she is willing to do. She doesn't like it and she's sort of unhappy about it. But fundamentally, you know, she's like, I've already like got blood on my hands. I got to keep going.
So how does it end?
Well, basically she eventually kills the chancellor because he finds out and is trying to track down Philo, who at this point has been in jail but is now on the run. And she figures out that Philo is in love with Vignette. So she brings Vignette to the mansion. And so there's like the climax is basically Philo coming into the mansion, trying to fight with I forgot what it's called. The big monster. And then actually, while all this is happening, Vignette breaks loose and stabs Piety in the back of her head.
Holy shit.
And so Piety dies, which also kills the Dark Asher.
So the Dark Asher was Piety's. That makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so Philo and Vignette think they're going to just run away at this point. Because Philo at this point is like all in. And like one of the things that happens in the last few episodes is that he really sort of embraces his identity as a Fae. And basically there are multiple times where he has the opportunity to, you know, continue his secret. And he decides to sort of just be open and honest about it. And like it goes very badly because it turns out everyone freaks out and everyone hates him for this, which is what he predicted, but he sort of stands behind it. And I think that's kind of what needed to happen for them to come back together, was like that he wasn't going to feel like he was trapped between two worlds, but more he's like, this is who I am. I'm with you. But then what happens is there's this whole other plot about this cult that's been planning to kill the mayor as well. And they actually didn't succeed in killing him, not the mayor, the chancellor, but they get blamed for it. And so because of that, there's this crackdown where none of the Critch, which I think is sort of the catch-all term for all the different fantasy races, none of them are allowed to leave the city. So right as Philo and Vignette are about to leave, they're sort of stopped by the police and told, no, you got to go back. We're all like sending everyone back and sequestering them in Carnival Row. They go and they see, like, they're basically turning Carnival Row into this,
like,
this camp. Yeah. Yeah, like they're putting up fences and barbed wire. I mean, it's, again, very on the nose. And so Vignette gets escorted into the camp, and then the guard tells Philo, no, this is Critch only. And there's this moment of hesitation where Vignette actually tells him, no, like, you should don't make trouble. I'll figure out how to get out of here. But then Philo just says, no, I'm a Critch as well. And so he goes into the camp and then they're sort of, they embrace, and that's the end of the season.
Interesting. I will say that I think one of the most powerful storylines or emotional bits to the whole thing was the fact that Philo had his wings clipped, to me, like that. And he has this scene where he's talking about, like, I felt it, you know, I feel it all the time. Like, and there's a flashback to him as a little kid jumping on the bed saying, I can fly, you know? And it's just like, to have something like that ripped from you, to like have the urge and desire and need to fly, you know, and have your wings cut, clipped. It just is really sad. Like, it got me, got under my skin a little bit, you know?
I agree that, like, that made him this sort of much more compelling character to me, because before he was basically this combination of war hero who left someone he loved behind and, you know, the cop who doesn't play by the rules, but fundamentally is a good guy and gets results. And so I think this felt, you know, a lot less familiar, like adding that dimension. It sort of fit with those other parts of him, but, you know, it really felt like, yeah, something that I hadn't seen before, and it gave him this sense of weight and this sense of tragedy. I will say that, I mean, yeah, Orlando Bloom, again, like, not a bad actor, but not necessarily showing a lot of range in here. Like, it felt like he played all of it with this sort of just very kind of grim expression. Maybe somebody slightly better could have given it a little bit more life and a little bit more variety.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I liked the show.
I did too. I mean, I just to like, I think because we can talk a little bit more in spoilers here, but just like one of the reservations I had was just how quickly they go through stuff, which I like in some ways because it makes the world feel rich in a way where it's not just, oh, we invented this one thing and the whole show is about this one thing.
Yeah.
But it does sometimes feel like they were really trying to squeeze stuff in. So like, for example, there's this whole stuff, and it's kind of related to what you were saying about A plots and B plots and C plots, where they're aren't really B plots, except there is this whole other storyline about the Spurnrose family and this Puck who moves in next door, which
felt totally disjointed. Like, does that come back in any way that like is equal to Philo and Vignette? Or
no, it doesn't ever reconnect with Philo and Vignette. It becomes this whole, so that's really the only true B plot, I would say. And aside from that, the way it's structured is it's more like when Philo and Vignette encounter people that you follow the story, and then it sort of gets dropped as stuff happens. And so, like, for example, like there's this whole, I mean, one of my favorite parts of it was the introduction of this group called the Black Raven, which is like this like militant fae group and led by this really interesting character who's like very ruthless. And as soon as Vignette like has another story, Black Raven are just completely forgotten about, and you just like don't see them at all in like the second half of the season, which I thought was like a real loss. You know, in the same way, like this whole other cult that like tries to kill the mayor, they kind of come out of nowhere. And so there's like a lot of pieces that it feels like, oh, and then there's this whole character called Darius, who's a werewolf, who's been a childhood friend of Philo, and you know, none of that stuff really goes anywhere. It just sort of pops up for an episode or two and kind of fades into the background again. I would imagine that a lot of it, you know, will come back in later seasons if they get to. I think they've already gotten approval to do a green light to do a second season. But, you know, yeah, like more of that stuff, I imagine, is sort of setting up seeds for future seasons too.
Yeah. So you think this will do well enough for renewals?
I mean, it's already been renewed for a second season. I think maybe that was just part of the deal, you know, because you got like to get the show, I think they might have had to commit to two seasons. Yeah, and I think, you know, they were just like, all right, like Orlando Bloom, fantasy, sure, why not? I'm glad it's getting a second season. I think like it's definitely not an A-plus show yet, but like it's a lot of fun, and I'm really enjoying watching it. And I think it also does get better as it goes along.
Yeah, I definitely think it gets better. Like the first episode, I feel like was a little bit like slow and clunky, and it really picked up. It picked up like a lot once we figured out Philo was formerly Fae or half Fae or whatever. But yeah, I would say watch it. I'm going to finish it, I think, even though it's been spoiled. But I would, my reco would be watch it.
I agree. And so next week, we're going to watch Mindhunter Season 2, right?
Yeah, Mindhunter Season 2. I watched Season 1. I really enjoyed it. For those of you who don't know, if you're going to watch along with us, it's based on true events. It's set in the 70s, and it's about these two guys. They have different names in the show, but it's about these two guys who were in the FBI who essentially developed the entire idea of a criminal profile and the idea of a serial killer. Like, you know, before this, there was no, oh, well, you know, sociopaths are normally incredibly smart, but don't hold jobs that reflect that, or, you know, whatever the profile that you hear police and detectives and stuff talking about when they're hunting down these violent criminals. That was started by these guys. And the way they did it was by interviewing crazy ass serial killers. It's creepy and fun and really interesting, and I think pretty well done for what it is. So just a little teaser.
Yep. And I am looking forward to checking it out. I'm also looking forward to probably next week finding out what Daryl thought of Carnival Row. But in the meantime, if you enjoy the podcast, you can always subscribe or leave us a review in Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. You can also send us your thoughts at originalcontent@techcrunch.com. And everyone, have a great weekend.
Yes, have a good weekend. Bye-bye.